Six months from the date of his not guilty plea, the pending charges shall be dismissed. Subsection 6 provides an exception to this rule when the prosecuting attorney has exercised due diligence to obtain material evidence and there are reasonable grounds to believe the evidence will be available at a later date. We are not disputing the materiality of the evidence. The state has agreed it was their burden to prove they were entitled to the exception and that this court reviews the decision based on the facts that were before the court at the time. Based on the cases in my at page one of my reply brief, review is de novo. And I did cite one case in my opening brief, but I cited additional cases in the reply brief. In this case, Marcelina, whose testimony is at issue, and Mr. Trujillo were arrested and charged in November 2008. Mr. Trujillo pled not guilty in February 2009. His trial was set July 13, and speedy trial ran on August 2nd of 2009. 5 days before the July 13 trial, the prosecutor requested a continuance to after Marcelina's trial, which was scheduled in November because she was asserting her Fifth Amendment right. She was still working on a disposition with Marcelina, and she asserted that Marcelina would be available after her trial if the deal didn't go through. In fact, as defense counsel argued, the prosecution did not establish due diligence because they had 8 months to negotiate a plea with Marcelina or offer her immunity if they needed her testimony. The prosecution had no explanation for why 5 days before the scheduled jury trial and on the morning of the scheduled jury trial, there was no disposition. And additionally, the prosecution failed to establish reasonable grounds to believe that Marcelina will be available on the date requested.
Does the prosecutor have to guarantee that the witness will be available in order to satisfy the requirements of due diligence?
Well, I don't think that those are actually two different requirements. The first requirement is due diligence, and the second is a showing of reasonable grounds to believe she will be available. So I think first, they just completely dropped the ball on due diligence. They didn't explain why this wasn't done before. And then the second requirement is a showing of a reasonable grounds to believe that the evidence will be available. Now, I don't think that means beyond a reasonable doubt or, you know, a guarantee with absolute 100% certainty. However, it is a showing in addition to due diligence, and it's a showing of a reasonable ground to believe that the evidence will, not may, but will be available.
Well, sorry to interrupt. What must be shown for due diligence?
Well, I think that the prosecution had a duty to explain why this was happening so late in the process. When there were 8 months to deal with this issue, the prosecution basically said, listen, there's an offer on the table, but it's not really on the table because it was contingent on this external condition, which was that the police had to verify the accuracy of information that Marcelina had provided in a completely different case. The question is, why is this happening 5 days before trial? And there was no explanation given for that.
Could I interject again? In the motion, the prosecutor pointed out the detective or the police were doing due diligence, trying to verify whatever information she had, but said due diligence, and we believe that a plea is going to be reached and a contingency is going to be, she testified. I mean, that was pled and put in the motion when it was a reconsideration motion, but is that?
Well, the problem is the motion was filed 5 days before trial, and as I recall, the motion doesn't say they've been doing due diligence for the last 8 months.
Well, I have it in front of me. It doesn't say the last 8 months, but detectives have acted with due diligence to investigate upon the information provided to them by Marcelina. The people have recently met with the assigned lead detective and the sergeant. regarding the status. As a result of that meeting, additional detectives has been assigned and a deadline for completion of October 5th was agreed to. And it says also the people have not been entered into the plea agreement because they're working to corroborate her statements. I gotta, like, do you think more needs shown than
absolutely
that?
Because what I just heard you say is that now we're working on it. I think they waited too long.
So at an earlier point, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what should be shown or what should be fled
well,
or proven.
Well, I think in a case like this where the prosecutor wants the co-defendant to testify against her co-defendant, the efforts needed to begin much sooner in the process than 5 days before his trial, when speedy trial was.
Well, we don't know when the efforts began, is what you're saying.
Well, the problem is it was the prosecutor's burden to establish due diligence. So if we don't know when they began, then I think we should infer that they began when the motion was filed. She needed to, or he needed to, explain what efforts were taken sooner and didn't do so. On the second factor, the reasonable grounds to believe that the evidence will be available, not only was the offer subject to this external condition, which, as you know, was not ultimately met, but the sides hadn't even committed definitively to this deal. That Marcelina hadn't said, I will accept this deal if it's offered to me. It was still tentative.
So they had to have a signed and sealed deal before they could have established due diligence. The fact that negotiations are underway is not sufficient.
Well, I would agree with that. I don't know that a signed deal would necessarily do it, but certainly with what we have here, it's not good enough. Because the problem is, if you look at the Smith case from 2011, I mean, anything could happen. And Smith talks about how, well, you know, the defense wanted a continuance because they wanted to call the co-defendant, and they said, well, the co-defendant's going to do this deal, and then he's going to be sentenced, and so can you extend my trial past the sentencing date? And this court said, well, anything could happen, you know, the sentencing could be continued. You haven't shown us that this witness will be available. And so I would ask you to apply that same standard here, where my client's speedy trial right was at stake. And I also want to remind the court that the state could have gone forward without Marcelina, or they could have offered her immunity. I mean, they had options. They had Mr. Lucero's testimony. He identified all of the players and gave the account of what happened to him. He was the actual victim in the case. So it's not as if this would have meant dismissing the case. I don't know if the court's interested in hearing about the Kuhlbeck case. I would note...
I think we've read it, but go ahead.
You do want to hear about it?
I just say I think we read it, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I do just want to note that in the answer brief, the state pointed out the possibility that the co-defendant, that Kuhlbeck noted the possibility that the co-defendant might waive their appeal, so they might be available. And my response to that is that there's no reason to believe Marcelina or anybody convicted of serious felonies and entitled to court-appointed counsel would waive their appeal. I might win the lottery tomorrow, but there's no reason to believe that I will win the lottery, even though I bought a ticket. And the other thing that Kuhlbeck noted was, well, it's possible the co-defendant might be acquitted of everything, and if they're acquitted of everything, then maybe then they'd be available. But here, Mr. Lucero, I don't know what the evidence was against the co-defendant and Kuhlbeck, but Mr. Lucero accused Marcelina of forcing him at gunpoint to drive to the 7-Eleven, telling her friends that he had hit her and basically orchestrating his assault and robbery. So the likelihood of her being acquitted of all counts and all lesser counts provides no reasonable ground to believe that she would be available.
At gunpoint or at knife point?
Did I say gunpoint? I apologize. At knife point. Thank you. Okay, and Kulbeck also seemed to think our statute would permit the prosecution to just wait until the co-defendant's privilege had expired. But in fact, it requires due diligence. It required them to do something to make them available. If the court has no other questions about speedy trial, I will move on to the gang evidence. Once again, 5 days before the trial, this is now the rescheduled trial, the prosecution wants to change the game again. Once again, the prosecution is telling Mr. Trujillo something for the first time. This one of the officers we endorsed, who was just a Colorado Springs police officer, one of many, is going to testify as a gang expert. Of course, Mr. Trujillo objected based on Rule 16. He argued this was not relevant, this is not helpful, this may overwhelm and mislead the jury. And I want to specifically note that one of the two motions he filed opposing this evidence argued that this evidence would violate due process, his right to confront witnesses, and his right to be afforded effective assistance of counsel. He also told the court if he had been notified in a timely manner, he would have investigated this issue. He would have sought funding from ABC to get an expert, and Mr. Trujillo received 96 years in this case, so he likely would have gotten that funding. The court did find a discovery violation, and that's important because there is mention in the answer brief to the Greer case, which I know, Judge Graham, you authored, which suggested that there was no requirement for parties to notify the opposing side that a witness would be called as an expert. I don't think you need to deal with that because the court found a discovery violation, but I would just note that that is not consistent with the Supreme Court's interpretation of Rule 16 in the Stewart case.
Although it is consistent with the rule.
I defer to you, Judge, only for purposes of this argument. And I'm glad we're not being recorded. So the court found a discovery violation, but the court didn't apply the law that governs whether and what sanctions should be granted. And that law required the court to consider the reason for the violation. And here the prosecutor said, well, I've known for the last 2 months that I was going to call Officer Andrews as an expert, but, you know, he wouldn't get back to me with his CV, so I never told the defense.
Is there anything in the record indicating when the CV, and I think there's also some brief report too, wasn't there?
The brief report, it deals with some police contacts with Mr. Trujillo and one officer's opinion he was no longer in the gang, one officer's report that he was with gang members later, and I think Officer Andrews' examination of his tattoos. I think that's the extent of that report.
And does the record indicate when those documents, the CV and the report, were prepared?
Prepared, I don't know. The prosecutor said that Andrews was dragging his heels, apparently, and she provided it, I think, 5 days before the rescheduled trial. But of course, her witness's conduct is chargeable to her, and there was no reason for her not to inform the defense. We're calling an expert in the event you want to look into getting an expert even before providing the CV. There really was no good reason for this violation. The next factor the court should have considered is the extent of the prejudice, which was obviously extreme in this case. The next factor the court should have considered is whether the violation could be cured by a continuance, which obviously in this case it could not, since Mr. Trujillo has this very viable speedy trial claim.
Assuming that speedy trial wasn't an issue, would the prejudice have been cured by a continuance?
I would be more concerned that you would think so. If there were no speedy trial claim here, I'm sure you would consider that, but there was. And the defense attorney, I believe, said if it weren't for that, we would be asking for more time. We would be getting an expert so that I could be effective. But the prosecution put the defense in a position where Mr. Trujillo had to choose. You can have one or you can have the other. And he chose to keep that speedy trial claim because that violation is so clear.
Was this the first time this, and I haven't read this part of the record, is this the first time that this detective had testified as an expert on gang activity?
I apologize, I don't recall. But I don't think there's any indication that the defense had any inkling that he would be called in that capacity. Like I said, he was a Colorado Springs police officer, and this was a Colorado Springs case, and I'm sure a number of officers were endorsed.
Well, let me get to a more fundamental question. This is, according to the district attorney's theory, this is a gang-related case. Is that right?
Well, that's what they announced 5 days before the rescheduled trial.
So how is this a gang-related case?
I think that's an excellent question. I mean, that was...
Answer it, then.
I don't think it was. I mean, obviously, that was the second objection. The first objection was this is a discovery violation. You can't call this expert because you gave us no notice. I would have done all these things. The second objection is there's no evidence that the victim was in a gang. There's no evidence that Marcelina was in the gang.
Well, no, there's a suggestion throughout, it seems to me, that Marcelina was part of the gang family, at least, or was affiliated with this gang somehow.
I don't think there was any evidence that she was a member or affiliate in any kind of formal capacity. Certainly, she was good friends with Mr.
Well, I think
Trujillo.
They used the word family, didn't they? Didn't
well,
she?
The prosecutor used the word family in her opening statement. She called it Marcelina's gang family. I don't think Marcelina used that word. But that's part of the reason why they didn't need the evidence either, is that there was already
the expert evidence you're talking about.
Right. Or really any of the gang evidence was that there was already this close relationship between Marcelina and both Mr. Trujillo and Mr. Rodriguez.
So you think this is not relevant at all?
Well, that is my
Starting point,
okay. Exactly.
Well, I mean, Marcelina changed her story, and that's certainly, gang retaliation could certainly suggest the reason for that, right?
And there was testimony from her. She testified that snitching is bad and that retaliation is possible. And so even if you were to believe that some minimal or limited evidence about the fact that Mr. Trujillo is in a gang and perhaps that there is this possibility of retaliation was relevant, what happened at the trial went so far beyond that, that it's my position that due process fundamental fairness was violated in this case.
Where? In other words, where's the line?
Well,
Colorado is certainly a jurisdiction where a lot of this gang evidence comes in for a lot of reasons.
I don't think there's been a published appellate case like this.
But where is the line? If some of this evidence is relevant, where would you draw that line for due process or
relevancy? I think all you need to know is that the line was crossed in this case, and it's clear the line was crossed in this case.
Why?
How do we know in order for us to know if the line has been crossed, we kind of need to know where the line is.
Well, Okay, this brings me to something that I wanted to draw to your attention before I have to sit down, and that is that one of the gang cases I cited in my opening brief has been reversed. That is the Blackmon versus Booker case. It's been reversed by the Sixth Circuit, and that citation is 696 F3rd 536. And the reason, I mean, I first want to tell you that to be candid, but I also want to tell you that because there's some discussion in that case about due process. First of all, the reason it was reversed is because that was a federal habeas case reviewing a state court conviction, and the Sixth Circuit found that the federal district court exceeded the limitations that the habeas statute imposes on federal review. The bar is extremely high in federal court. The defendant was required to show no possibility that any fair-minded jurist could disagree that a U.S. Supreme Court decision was unreasonably implied. So that doesn't apply to you, obviously. But what's interesting about Blackmon, and I also just want to point out that what happened in the Blackmon case didn't even approach what happened here. The evidence that came in that case, nowhere near. There was no expert in that case. Basically, Blackmon wasn't even as bad as where this case was before Andrews got on the stand. But Blackmon talks about the fundamental fairness claim and basically acknowledges, well, there's not really a line that the initial reviewing court makes the call, basically. And I'm paraphrasing. But it's not that kind of an issue that you could, because it always depends on these factual circumstances, I don't know how you would define what the line is. It's that the initial reviewing court decides, you know, whether, and it has to be awfully bad, I agree with that. It's got to so infect the proceedings with unfairness that due process is violated, but you get to make that call. And then, for example, the federal court more or less has to defer to you unless there's a U.S. Supreme Court case saying otherwise. So that may actually be helpful to you on that issue. Let's see. So, you know, I want to make another correction to a citation in my brief. The Quevedo case, it's not Quevado, it's Quevedo. And that is 203 P3rd 609. I had put 230 P3rd. I hope one of your clerks has already caught that. And that was a case ruling gang evidence inadmissible, Colorado case. So I don't think this is a gang case. The expert testimony wasn't relevant. It wasn't helpful. In fact, it went completely over the top in this case. And in particular, the testimony that the Serranos are governed by the Mexican Mafia, which controls the California prison system, that they're known for committing illegal distribution of narcotics, that they're known for killing people and assaulting people. You typically see those kind of crimes. Home invasions are big. They have a reputation for violence among other gangs, that some gang members will use violence just for being looked at wrong, that if anyone snitches, there would be a retaliation attack. This is an expert telling the jury this. And I think it's not surprising that the jury reacted the way that they did in this case.
You're talking about Juror 6,
in particular, but she wasn't the only one. There was one or two other jurors who had submitted.
At what point in the trial did they start to submit those concerns?
It was before the expert. It was when there was emphasis on the gang evidence and opening statement. The lead detective, Seigert, used the word gang 12 times in the first couple pages of his testimony. They were just being pounded with this gang idea. Marcelina explained the Serranos to the jury, again making the expert completely unnecessary. Seigert was called back and explained Mr. Trujillo's tattoo, again, making the expert completely unnecessary. The first note was submitted after Marcelina kept injecting the shooting, that she saw someone get shot in front of her, which the prosecutor said was completely unrelated to this case, but of course the jury doesn't know that. They think this has something to do with the Serranos. And then they submitted another note after she testified, and this was specifically elicited, that the teardrop tattoo, which Mr. Trujillo had, indicates prior incarceration. And then they wanted to ask another officer about gangs, even though that officer was just testifying about his contact with Mr. Lucero. So the jury was understandably focused on this and concerned about this in light of the testimony that came out. If there are no other questions, I'm going to save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Wiggin?
May it please the court, Nicole Wiggins, bar number 42727, appearing on behalf of the people today, Your Honors. I will follow defense counsel's suit and start with the speedy trial claim. And the people do contend in this case that there was clearly due diligence and reasonable availability based on the Kulbeck case, which essentially lines up very, very closely to the facts we had in this case, Your Honor. Kulbeck, same as this case, we had an accomplice set for trial 6 weeks after the defendant's trial. Made an incriminating statement against the defendant that the people were entitled to get before the jury. They had a tentative agreement. Excuse me. We don't know why that was tentative. It could have been for exactly the same reason it was in this case. The police were checking it out a little further. We don't know why it was tentative, however, the facts are exactly the same. And it required the court in this case to continue the case, and they did so properly. And the prosecutor did set out due diligence. We had two hearings about this, Your Honors. In the first one, the court did agree with the defense. And they said, you know what, right now, I don't think you're showing me enough of an agreement to set this case over. And it was continued on behalf of a different witness. Now, when it was continued on behalf of Marcelina, at that point, the court had spoken to Marcelina's attorney and had been assured by him that a disposition had been reached. At that point, I feel that the trial court was on pretty safe ground to say there's reasonable grounds that this testimony will become available. And the court did not set it out, you know, 3, 4, or 5 months down the line to see what would happen. The court set it out until October, until the next disposition date in Marcelina's trial, so that we could keep this moving forward and due diligence would keep be getting done, so to speak.
Excuse me,
if
I could just break in, is there anything in the record to indicate when these negotiations began?
No, Your Honor, there isn't any indication when the specific date when the prosecution began talking to Marcelina's attorney, began talking to the police regarding her. However, there is some stuff in the record that, you know, she was a witness in not one, but two, maybe even more than that trials, and that she was obviously a difficult witness and that they were having a hard time getting her to cooperate and that she was also working on other trials. So they did put this in front of the court of, look, we're not just dealing with this case here and the officers are kind of dealing with a lot. And that's why the court, at the end of the first hearing, the prosecution essentially said, Your Honor, we're still going to be working on this. If we come to you with a more firm agreement, will you revisit it? And the court said yes, and of course they did.
Sorry to interrupt. Let me interject
a
question. Do you agree with Ms. Griffin that the standard of review is de novo?
I don't, Your Honor.
What do
Not
you...
Not in this case. Several... I do agree that normally in a speedy trial claim, a lot of the cases do say the facts get clear deference, and then it's a de novo review. However, several cases that have reviewed this specific exception to the speedy trial statute have treated it as an abuse of discretion. And the case that I cited, although I did not flesh this out as well as I should have, I admit, the Abu case I cited does kind of give us a little bit more of a guide here. And basically what that case says is when a continuance violates a defendant's statutory speedy trial rights, then it does not involve disputed facts or matters of discretion, review is de novo.
So that sounds like a mixed question.
It does, but I think in this case, and particularly maybe this is why the cases that address this section treat it more as an abuse of discretion, because there are so many findings the trial court must go through that it really does end up putting a lot of discretion in the court's hands.
It can't be discretionary to violate speedy trial.
Several cases have reviewed it in that manner, Your Honor. And I would submit that because the court exercised a lot of discretion in this case, that would be the appropriate standard of review. However, the people do recognize that under other speedy trial claims, de novo is the standard of review.
Okay.
However, Scaliba, I want to say, Wolf, and also Kuhlbeck, all which specifically address this section of the speedy trial statute, use an abuse of discretion standard. So in that respect, they are somewhat conflicting, Your Honors.
Let me go back to the due diligence question.
Yes.
For purpose of the due diligence, would it have been sufficient if the prosecution, let's say 3 or 4 weeks before trial, said, we better get working on getting Marcelina to trial. Let's see if we can negotiate a deal. Would that constitute due diligence? And let's say they went to work pretty hard and they got to where they went to where they were representing at the 5 days before trials to where they were. Would that be sufficient to satisfy due diligence, or were they obligated to begin much earlier?
Your Honor, I think that would depend on the nature of the witness and the testimony. I think in this case, because the prosecution conceded that the witness was somewhat difficult, that it was important that we establish that they had been talking. We don't know the exact date, but the implication is for a while we've been trying to get this witness. I don't know if there's a specific time period that you need to show. I think particularly there's been some cases about subpoenaing witnesses and all, and those deal with timetables as well. And I don't think that there really is a specific timetable that a prosecutor needs to say, well, this is when we started. I think 2 or 3 days before trial and you're just now trying to get the witness, that would be more of a problem. But that's not an issue here, because we do have on the record, look, we are trying. We are contacting her attorney. We are in contact with the police. And I do believe that at some point there was a meeting in chambers regarding this as well. Of course, that's not on the record. It's referred to on the record that the judge met with Marcelina and or her attorney in chambers was the implication. So I think a couple of days before trial, they just show up with her and they just now say they picked her up maybe. I think that would be more of an issue, because then that would take more time. But as the prosecutor demonstrated, we picked her up. I think they picked her up in December. They've been working to corroborate her statements for a couple months now. And that month delay doesn't indicate that those months delay doesn't indicate a lack of due diligence, but quite the opposite, just that they are trying to make sure that they cover all their bases before they bring this witness before the court.
Well, we don't know, but that's a possibility anyway.
Possibility. In terms of reasonable availability, speaking to what Judge Graham said earlier, we did not need a guarantee. The prosecutor doesn't have to get up there and guarantee this witness is going to testify. All that we need is a reasonable availability. And I do think specifically the attorney's assurance to the court that we have reached a disposition afforded the court the discretion to make the ruling that testimony would be reasonably available. And the duration of her Fifth Amendment privilege is only relevant as it bears on that reasonable possibility or probability that the testimony will come forward, which will vary, I believe, in almost every single case. Moving on to the gang evidence.
Ms. Wiggins.
Yes.
Why is this a gang case? When you talk in your brief about race gestae, I'm having a difficult time wrapping my head around why this is res gestae. This doesn't appear to be gang activity. It appears to be an assault by a couple of people. And it's befuddling to me that the prosecutor was given this much leeway to treat this as a gang case.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a gang case, and this evidence is res gestae. because these individuals acted as a gang to protect an affiliate of the gang.
So it's your position, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's your position that Marcelina was part of this gang?
It is my position that the evidence established that she was closely affiliated enough with this gang that it made logical sense that they were acting to protect her. And the evidence further shows that because earlier in the night, these three gentlemen, including the defendant, got in a fight, another fight on her behalf. It very much appeared that when she said jump, you know, they said how high. And they acted in concert earlier in the evening, just as they did against our victim here. All of them were members of the gang.
All of them, but defendant, my question directly addressed whether she is.
No.
They may want to beat up somebody that's harassing her, whatever, people do things. But tying that into the gang, that's my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry to interrupt that.
No, I'm sorry. The evidence of Marcelina's affiliation is this. They get in that yes, she told the officer that she was in a gang. However, that's objected to and
sustained.
They get in, she calls the gang her family.
Okay, now what
is that?
We hear
later testimony that can mean gang affiliation. Can, not always 100% of the time. But we do get that into evidence that a lot of gang members refer to each other as family. She refers to these guys as family. Her brother is a member of this gang. She seems to know a lot about the gang. And that basically, in my opinion, establishes her close affiliation. However, I do agree that it was never unsustained on the record where she said, yes, I am a member of this gang 100%. She did. There was a great deal of evidence that she was extremely closely affiliated to the point where these men obviously acted to protect her in concert. And further, the reason why I believe this is res gestae, Your Honor, going back to your question a little bit, is that this normal friendships don't explain this behavior. The reaction here can't be explained by a couple guys having a night out on the town. She essentially sets them up. The victim here arrives in a parking lot, and three guys kind of swarm him, three guys that are on the record confirmed members of the same gang, swarm him without any questions asked, without any sort of what's going on here, why are we here? I mean, they were there waiting. And normal friendships just don't explain that reaction. That's why it was important to establish that these guys were members of a gang who were acting to protect against a perceived wrong to an affiliate, someone very closely affiliated with their gang.
Okay, right, well, assume that that's right for a moment. How does the Mexican Mafia...
That was the question I was
going to ask. And running prisons in California, having some sort of supervisory powers over the defendant in this case, how in the world does that have anything to do with res gestae?
Your Honor, I think once the gang evidence was ruled admissible, they have to give some sort of evidence of the gang. The gang affiliation is meaningless unless it explains how and why the affiliation was a motivator. And that the evidence about the Mexican Mafia was really brief. And basically, they're just trying to establish where these guys are and where they come from.
But there was no tie linking people from Southern California or Mexico to anything that's going on.
Well, essentially, what the testimony did was start out at a higher hierarchy and kind of go down to the sect that the defendant belonged to. And I believe that's what the prosecution was trying to get to. Look, there's a lot. This is a large gang. Defendant belongs to this small sect here in town.
Okay, for you to just explain that to us took 10 seconds.
Agreed, Your Honor. Agreed.
So, I mean, do you think there is some point where a line could be crossed? You obviously don't think that happened here, but it seems to me, I mean, the normal gang case is retaliation or something that is clearly gang conduct.
Right. Are you saying, is there a line to be crossed once in admitting gang evidence, period, or once the evidence is ruled admissible?
Either.
Either. I think, Your Honor, I think there was always a line to be crossed. I just don't think it was crossed here.
Well, even if we just adopt a 403 analysis, wouldn't you agree that under such an analysis, to have jurors submit letters indicating that they're fearful, that pretty much proves the 403 analysis, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think jurors' reaction should ever dictate our evidence. I think jurors can become frightened by any number of things, and I think the mere mention of gang once is enough to frighten some jurors.
Well, the question is, of course, prejudice, undue prejudice to the defendant.
I don't think that because one juror is scared, that means that there's undue prejudice on judicial review.
But the juror indicated she was afraid.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before the deliberations, or somewhere maybe right as they started, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The juror did indicate fear. However, I don't feel that the fear translates into a judicial finding of unfair prejudice that substantially outweighed any sort of relevance.
But we know gang evidence can certainly be that way, can it not?
Your Honor, it does have the potential to prejudice, obviously it does.
So,
but the standard is unfair prejudice.
I understood. So, there's perhaps some relevance to some gang evidence, but could this be the case where the line was crossed?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I also would point out that I don't recall that the juror specifically said what it was that was intimidating her. Now, at that point, we could look at a line that the juror was saying, hey, you crossed the line here, this scared me. It seemed to me that there was just a general assertion of fear.
But the fear was linked to gangs. That's clear.
Yes, Your Honor, that is clear on the record.
Well, and the evidence was that this gang will commit violence for no reason at all, and it will particularly do it to retaliate against people that they believe are harming their interests. And then to top it off, they say, and there's 400 of these people right here in Colorado Springs. So the prosecution must have known this would scare the crap out of jurors, wouldn't they?
Your Honor, I can't speak to the prosecution's intention. I do think that
I'm not saying what their intention was, but that was something that one could have, a reasonable person could have anticipated when they're offering that evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's boil this case down to what it was, whether gang motives or not. The victim testified that this defendant participated, jumped in the truck, participated in this kidnapping and assault, right?
Correct.
The gang evidence provides perhaps some context to that, but this really is a case that boils down to, is this victim credible, believable to this jury? Right?
Well, I think that always is a main consideration, but Your Honors, I also want to point out that the gang evidence was relevant to Marcelina's change of statement and testimony.
Okay, again, I think there's a couple of bases for the relevance. I'm not too concerned about that level, but at some point, there was a lot of evidence about gangs.
Your Honor, the evidence regarding how this gang operates, I feel that was essential. If the prosecution is trying to establish, look, Marcelina made an implicating statement about our defendant, and now she's changing your story, and you deserve why. And the why is she's terrified. Why is she terrified? Because these guys are violent. Without establishing,
because they would retaliate and that kind of thing.
Without establishing what she's afraid of and why, and the legitimized fear, then her change in statement doesn't have the same thrust, and the prosecution was entitled to explain why is she afraid.
But that took you about 15 seconds to explain that.
Understood, Your Honor. I just believe in this context, the loyalty among these members explains why this assault happened in the first place. Otherwise, there's just no reason for her to kind of lure this guy to a parking lot and then for them to just collectively assault him. And the fact that the victim is not a gang member and this is not a so-called gang hit is not fatal to the gang analysis. And Martinez the poor child in that case was not a member of a gang. The fact that the victim wasn't involved in gang dealings doesn't have any bearing on the relevance necessarily. So I do think it's somewhat similar to the Skinner case, where there was a lot of testimony about code of silence and inmate codes of silence, and the prosecution was establishing that, look, snitches get reacted upon violently. And that was necessary to establish why Marcelino was doing what she was doing. Otherwise, the jury could possibly think she's just a crazy person who just likes to change her stories to the police. When in fact, no, she was repeatedly being threatened. And the reason why she took those threats seriously is because of the way this gang operates. If your honors don't have any other questions about any other issues, the people would ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Let me ask you a little bit about the report. I don't think you've had a chance to talk about that yet, have you?
The discovery.
The prosecutor knew at least a couple months before that he was going to use Mr. Andrews as an expert witness. And he knew that he had to produce any report or other statements 30 days in advance. So didn't he have an obligation at 30 days to at least advise the PD that, look, I don't have the documents yet, but we're calling this guy as an expert and we will get the documents to you as soon as we can?
Yes.
And he didn't do that?
No, he didn't, and that's why the court found a violation.
So you're not contesting
that? Under the rules, no, Your Honor. I'm not contesting that under the rules, or it would have been a better practice for him to tell him that there's an expert. Under the rules, he has to produce the expert's report, and the court found a violation.
Okay. Then the next step in my mind is the expert. The only way that the best way to cure this problem would be a continuance.
Yes.
But here, obviously, the situation is the only way to get a continuance would be for the defendant to have to waive the right to speedy trial. Isn't that putting really undue pressure on the defendant under those circumstances to let this situation go so long so that the defendant with no choice but to live with the violation or waive his speedy trial?
Right, Your Honor. And as I said, it would have been better practice to give them a heads up, so to speak. But the case law stands for the proposition of, if you don't take that continuance, then it's going to be very hard for the court to find prejudice. And without prejudice, we can't find a violation. And there are several cases that speak to this, that are essentially, there's a lot of reasons why this might have happened. And it's kind of a too bad, so sad situation. And the defendant, I agree that he had to choose, but a tough choice is not the same as no choice. And the court was very amenable to a continuance in this situation. And I do know that at that point, it wasn't really going to benefit the people. The people had that plea agreement with Marcelina. She was ready to go. They were ready to go. Further continuance wasn't some sort of tactic on the people's part to get a further continuance at that point. We had already gotten what we needed the continuance for. So without accepting the continuance, I recognize that it is a tough spot, but as I said, a tough choice is not the same as no choice. And without the defendant accepting the continuance, which the court was more than willing to grant, it's very difficult under the case law to find any sort of prejudice.
Other than the having to make this choice. That's the prejudice is you can have a continuance if you waive your speedy trial right, which is obviously a valuable right of a defendant, or you can have a continuance. And so the prejudice was that they were forced to either forego the one right or the other.
Yes, Your Honor, but there are several cases that address it and essentially say that without accepting the continuance, even in the face of a speedy trial violation, that the defense is essentially out of luck. So, and I do know that it was late, but the lack of surprise is not to the extent that the defense was exhibiting to the court, even these motions to continue that we've been debating, that they debated, touched on the gang evidence and the gang retaliation. The fact that they went and filed a protection order to try to make Marcelina feel better about testifying, all that kind of stuff did put the defense on more notice than they were willing to concede that this was going to be a gang case. So I do think that the court went on for a while about a lack of surprise, and I do think the court was well-founded in noting that. And I do think the court went through the factors and talked with the parties about why this happened, and there wasn't an exceptional reason why. And then went through, you know, well, the prosecution, you really should have done this. And the court did go through the factors, and maybe it didn't cite case law on the record, but it's not as though this discovery violation was completely swept under the rug. It was addressed by the court. The court did acknowledge that there would be some sort of prejudice to the defendant, but that preclusion was too severe of a sanction, and it is a severe sanction, and the sanction is always supposed to be the least drastic. So the court, I believe, made the right decision in this discovery sanction.
So it was so obvious this was a gang case that the defendant should have known that he should have gotten an expert witness on gang.
No, Your Honor, I'm not contending that. I'm just contending that the amount of surprise should not have been to the level that has been exhibited, because it was, the gang affiliation was repeatedly brought up. Now, whether they should have been on notice for an expert, I mean, you would have to ask defense counsel, but I think that the court was correct in noting, hey, defense, you were on some sort of notice that this could be a gang case. Not that specifically this guy would be called as an expert, but that this might be an issue. And the lack of surprise did, I believe, factor into the court's finding and lack of prejudice. So if Your Honors have no further questions.
Thank you very much.
On the speedy trial issue, I just wanted to point out that Kuhlbeck, it appears that the offer in Kuhlbeck may have just been tentative in the sense that it hadn't been executed yet. It's not clear, but it certainly looks like it was less tentative. There certainly was no condition, as there was in this case. If the prosecutor had started working on this 2 or 3 weeks before, it was her burden to tell the court that, because it was her burden or his burden to establish due diligence, and that didn't happen. I'm not conceding that that would be sufficient, but we can't assume that happened where there was no representation that it did. I thought that the state's choice of words was really interesting, that a tough choice is not no choice, and too bad, so sad, because that's precisely how I view the position that the prosecutor was in, when really they ought to have been required to go forward without Marcelina or offer her immunity. They could still have gone forward with this prosecution. Mr. Trujillo's absolute guaranteed statutory speedy trial right was violated, and it was the court's duty to protect that right. And the fact that the prosecutor had to make a hard choice didn't mean that she didn't have any choice. I also wanted to point out that Mr. Trujillo, unlike the prosecutor, has constitutional rights and can't be forced to choose, or shouldn't be forced to choose, between his right to present an effective defense and have effective assistance of counsel, or his absolute statutory speedy trial right. And the Arledge case, in my opening brief, talks about how a defendant can't be forced to choose between speedy trial or a biased, unbiased judge. It's a very similar situation. On the issue of lack of surprise, I think that's absolutely inaccurate that there was no surprise. The fact that a case there might be body fluids and evidence doesn't put everyone on notice that there's going to be a DNA expert. The fact that there are tire tracks, pictures of tire tracks, doesn't mean everyone needs to be on notice and hire tire comparison experts. I mean, there needs to be some notice provided so that people can prepare their case and present a defense. Finally, on the issue of the gang evidence, I just wanted to reiterate that there was more than one juror submitting the concerns, at least two, and that, of course, this court can consider those concerns because the jurors themselves brought it to the court's attention. It's not an issue of inquiring of the jury and asking about their deliberations. These are matters that the jury brought up to the court because they were so troubled by them. And the specific concern that both jurors identified was the fact, well, the first juror said, I'm concerned that our identities were disclosed in open court now that there's this gang testimony. And the second one said, I'm concerned that the defendant knows who we are because he's in a gang. If there are no other questions, I will ask the court to vacate Mr. Trujillo's convictions or reverse the case. Thank you.
I want to just say something to both of you. You've done an outstanding job on this case in the briefs and arguments, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yes, we all thank you very much for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision coming forward in due course.